Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are graced with the presence of not one, but two remarkable individuals. Krista Tippett and David White are going to share with us their ideas, their writing, their wit, and hopefully the fruits of the wisdom they've gleaned thus far on their respective journeys. Krista Tippett represents the ballast voice of reason and calm on the NPR airwaves. For the past 10 years, her programme On Being has grown from strength to strength. And in 2014, President Obama awarded her the National Humanities Medal for thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. I won't belabor my introduction to David, who is a man of great industry and varied talent, which includes his internationally regarded poetry and prose. But in order to expedite matters and to maximize our time with the speakers, I will segue using Krista's own words. Poetry slows you down. And anything in our world now that slows us down is to be valued. So we embrace this opportunity and welcome Krista and David.
So Krista is usually the one who interviews and asks all the wonderful questions, but we're going to give her a night off that way, at least to begin with. And I thought I would pose some questions to her. So I wanted to ask Krista about her own art form, in a way, what I would call the art of asking beautiful questions. I do think there is a way of shaping a beautiful mind, and that we do this through asking very beautiful questions. They're actually beautiful and disturbing questions. And I often define a beautiful question as one that shapes your identity as much by asking it as by having it answered. Mm. So how much would you say that your artistry as an interviewer, as a conversationalist, as a beautiful questioner, informed the way you approached your book, Becoming Wise? Mm.
You know, our mutual, your old dear friend, John O'Donohue, mm-hmm. has this definition of beauty that I've carried around. Mm-hmm. Ever since I spoke with him those years ago, in the months before he died, mm-hmm. that beauty is that in the presence of which we feel more alive. Mm-hmm. And he distinguished between beauty and glamour. Mm-hmm. I think so much about the power of questions and what a mighty form of words a question is. Mm-hmm. And you putting the word beautiful together with that is a great way for me to kind of rearrange my thoughts yet again.
Yes.
But you know, basically what I've learned is that, you know, the way I say it is questions elicit answers in their likeness. And we actually see so many examples of this that are negative culturally and in media. And I think it's worth pondering when we see how, you know, these distorted exchanges, these combative exchanges that just get more combative as they go on. The thing is, you know, it's very hard to not meet a simplistic question with anything but a simplistic answer. It's very hard to transcend a combative question. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to resist a generous question. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful question will draw forth beauty from the other. And this is why, you know, we basically deal in competing answers in American life. And I long for us, I think it could be so redemptive and life-giving for us to meet each other for a while with our questions and finding shared questions even when we don't have something that feels like common ground to stand on. And so I love the language of adding the beauty to that.
Yes. And what would you say the central beautiful question was you took into writing when you first sat down at your desk?
Yeah. Well, the question that I took into writing this book was a question that came at me across the years people wondering, you know, saying, you've interviewed so many people with wise and graceful lives. What are the recurring qualities in wise and graceful lives, mm-hmm. in beautiful lives? So it was that investigation into what, how that beauty was generated, how it was formed. And when I started out, you know, I was very tantalized by the question, and I had all these chapter, these kind of lofty chapter headings. And then as I really investigated this, I got very close to the ground. You know, I really saw that wisdom emerges through the raw materials of our lives, mm-hmm. and actually words. And again, for me, questions are a mighty form of words. Words are one of those things. It's the first chapter. It's something we deal in words all day long, scarcely stopping to realize how powerful they are, although we all know that an exchange of words can make or break our day, and that we, with an exchange of words, can make or break someone else's day. And that's huge. Because, you know, what did Annie Dillard say? How we spend our days is how we spend our lives.
Now, a book I'm writing at the moment is on 7 timeless steps for deepening any conversation. And I always say the first step in the conversation is to stop having the one you're having now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would ask you, what conversation did you need to stop having in order to write the book?
Well, I actually had to put myself into the picture, because in the work I do, I draw out other people's wisdom.
You do, yeah. Yeah.
But what I know so well is that someone else's story, mm-hmm. and someone else's insights become listenable and land in the imagination of others and land in others' lives when they are willing to speak at the intersection, not just of what they know and what they do, but who they are, mm-hmm. to put themselves out there.
Yeah.
To use the first person.
Yeah.
Even if they are a great expert. And so I was writing something abstract and based on the words of others, and I realized that I had to put myself through the same paces that I ask other people to put themselves, you know, that I put other people through in conversation.
Yeah.
And that was really hard.
So you had to stop being just the witness.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Lovely.
Because, you know, there is this paradox, and I think you deal in this as well. We actually get at what is universal as we more clearly and honestly articulate what is particular, what we know, mm-hmm. close up. And I couldn't actually, in this form, put the wisdom of others out there without also pinning it to what I've learned.
And what did you find the central thing was that you had to contribute amidst all of this wisdom that you'd been witnessing all these years? What was your voice?
Well, that's kind of a hard question. Well, here's one thing. You know, I always ask, people who've heard the show know that I always start with some version of the question about the spiritual background of someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that for a few reasons. In fact, almost everybody has an interesting story about that. Even someone who will describe themselves as a cradle atheist has a great story about that. But I actually do it more importantly because where it plants the conversation. Because where you start a conversation, mm-hmm. shapes everything that follows. Just as you're saying, you start with a beautiful question, it goes from there. It's mm-hmm. hard to pull back when you start a conversation in the wrong place.
Yeah.
What I've learned across the years is also to have a much, well, I think I've learned in general to have a much more expansive understanding of what spiritual is and what spiritual life is. So some people's, many, many answers to that question do have to do with religious formation or lack thereof. But I've had answers to that question that had to do with loneliness or with love. And when I am asked about the spiritual background of my childhood, I always talk about my Southern Baptist preacher grandfather, who was all about rules, which were mostly about not having sex, directly or indirectly. Everything was a slippery slope. Everything. It was a real joy killer. But I realized when I was writing this that I had to, again, I had to think, I had to use that more expansive definition of what mm-hmm. spiritual is mm-hmm. and what the spiritual background of our childhoods are. And I realized that the spiritual background of my childhood was also in my nuclear family, where there were so many things, so many questions you were not allowed to ask. I know this doesn't make me very special, because a lot of our families are like this. It's kind of acute in my mm-hmm. family, that the really essential things we needed to talk about were unspeakable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so one thing I've seen about asking that question at the beginning of a conversation, and I'm right now not remembering your answer, it's so interesting how people often circle back to that. And the thing is, that question takes people to a place in us which is soft and searching, mm-hmm. not the prepared, professional way we present ourselves. We're trained to present ourselves in public. It's also a part of us that is full of questions. And it's interesting how often people articulate questions that they've ended up following all their lives by some direct or indirect route. So this is a long-winded way of saying that what I realized for the first time is that in some very primal way, everything I do now is driven by this growing up, wondering why I couldn't ask the important questions and why mm-hmm. we couldn't speak about these things out loud.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Hmm. There's a particular ancient, almost native form of conversation in the west of Ireland, in which is every conversation in the west of Ireland is based on the dynamic of subverting whatever foundation the conversation first began on. Yeah. And the conversation is deemed successful if the foundation on which you began is completely subverted. And I often think a sense of humor is actually a kind of spiritual practice. Because
yeah.
a sense of humor always tells you that whatever context you've arranged for yourself, there's always another context that makes your context absurd. Yeah? So quite often, the conversation openers in the west of Ireland are... they come out of this oblique field, you know, that's beyond everyday discourse. It's a kind of minding the invisible and understanding that whatever language you have to describe yourself or the world, it's not large enough, it's not movable enough, it's not seasonal enough, it's not tidal enough. There's a lovely pub in Connemara called Cain's. It's at a place called Marm. If you go in there on a winter's day, it's really quiet. There'll be just the clock ticking. And I always remember going in and saying to the old lads who were in there having a pint, how's it going? And there was just the clock ticking away there, and one of them turned and said, we're trying not to get too excited. Yeah. But I always remember going in there one day and ordering my pint. And there's this whole ritual around a pint of Guinness at the bar in Ireland, because...
it doesn't taste the same anywhere else.
Exactly, yeah.
It just tastes incredible there.
But this is leading to a question for
you. I'm enjoying the Guinness.
Good,
yeah.
But they pour the pint until a couple of inches from the top, and then they leave it and walk away. And if you're not familiar with this, this is quite frustrating, and it's always the moment when you realize just how thirsty you are. Yeah. And they leave it to settle. And that's the way a really good pint of Guinness is poured. It's not poured straight to the top. You pour it almost to the top, leave it, walk away. But it's always the signal in a local Irish pub for you to be spoken to as a stranger. You know? When the barman walks away, someone will say something to you, yeah, as an opener. And there was this fella there, he said, out of nowhere, he said, there was a fella on the telly last night saying, we have to rethink infinity. He said. And I said, well, how are you doing with it? And he says, well, he said, I'm 3 pints into it. And I'm no further along than I was the first time. But you really, it really did make you think, what would it be like to think about infinity and to rethink? Many of us haven't even begun the first thought about infinity, never mind rethinking it, you know. So just the act of posing this nonsensical but serious question through humor, you know, puts you into a larger context where you're looking from the other side of the question you've refused to ask. Yeah. And to my mind, this is a really interesting dynamic, that veil you come across. And you always come across it in a book, looking almost onto the page from the other side of the question.
When you're writing a book, you mean?
In the midst of writing a book, you always get to a point where the initial foundation is being subverted by some larger context. Yeah.
Well, there's this process of discovery, which I feel happens in writing and also happens in a conversation, a real conversation, that we suddenly put words around something that we never put words around just by ourselves because of the exchange with someone else.
Yes.
Yeah. And it happens, too, that sometimes you write something down. It's the first time you knew that, which is so mysterious.
Exactly, yeah. I often think poetry is the art of overhearing yourself say things you didn't want to know. Thank you very much.
You know, I've quoted you a lot this year from our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I speak with poets, I always ask, what is it that poetry works in us? You know, and you can ask that question and I keep collecting answers.
Yeah.
And they're all true, right? It's like building to. And you said, poetry is language against which we have no defense.
Mm-hmm.
And we as a production team, as this year 2016 progressed, found ourselves putting more and more and more poets on the air. And in fact, we were in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in the summer, and we put Michael Longley,
lovely,
the great Northern Irish poet, on the air for election weekend, which was our contribution.
Yes.
And I was intrigued and not at all surprised that the day after the election, there was this surge, which has continued to go on, and people reading poetry and downloading poetry and reciting poetry in public.
Yes.
And we're very aware and speaking about the failure of forms of language we thought we could rely on, like facts and truth. And I actually think that had become problematic.
Mm-hmm.
It's been problematic for a long time, this idea that we've had about information itself being a solution, or facts alone being able to tell the whole truth.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, now the problem is out on the surface. And your sentence that poetry is language against which we have no defense was an important way for me to understand why poetry is so helpful now, at such a contrast.
Yeah. Well, what you said earlier is really true, that you can't speed read poetry. You actually have to be in the frame of existence, even just for one line. I mean, the marvelous thing about poetry, too, is you only need to read one line. One line a day, truly read, has an enormous effect on your grounding yourself in reality, which is not a sense of narrowing around agreed forms of what is and what isn't. It's meeting this frontier between what you think is you and what you think is not you, and which is where all the real stuff happens. And it's very fierce, it's very fiery, it's very passionate. Do you want to hear a little piece I wrote about the act of writing poetry?
Yeah.
It's about the physical bodily act of writing poetry. Good poetry begins with the lightest touch. Good poetry begins with the lightest touch. A breeze arriving from nowhere. A whispered, healing arrival. A word in your ear. A settling into things. Then, like a hand in the dark, it arrests the whole body, stealing you for revelation. In the silence that follows a great line, you can feel Lazarus deep inside, even the laziest, most deathly afraid part of you, lift up its hands and walk toward the light.
Mm.
What is that light? It's the light of a real conversation. It's the interesting thing about a real conversation is it doesn't have to solve anything, whether it's in a workplace or in a marriage. You know, as soon as you start having it, the other person starts feeling real again. You start feeling real, and you have a way to walk forward, yeah, mm-hmm. to walk forward.
Well, I would like to welcome anybody who would like to pose a question to come up to the microphone.
I wanted to go back to your conversation about beautiful questions and ask if you had tools to use or kind of more general wisdom on being a better listener, how you really engage and kind of deeply, you know, take in what someone's saying and react to it in the way that's meaningful.
You know, I think this is something, I think listening is a basic social art, but we don't, it's actually something you have to practice. So there probably are books, but I think just doing it, you know, it's not just that we've unlearned. We don't practice it, but it's not just that. A lot of the ways we do get trained to interact with others in public actually work against listening. Like, we have all been trained to be advocates. We're taught to represent ourselves, our identity, our positions, and that's part of the toolkit we need, but it's not the whole toolkit. You know, we also deal, essentially, when we discuss any issue, well, first of all, we describe things as issues, right? And we narrow it to two sides, and really, any important question, two sides, is an impoverished way to come at it. Right, and so just that. So I think we have to question some things that feel so natural. They're so habitual that it feels like it's the only way it can be done. And, you know, so I think the way I really think the way we've internalized listening is I'll be quiet while that person says what they have to say until it's my turn to say what I have to say, and I'll be good at that. I think some really simple, vulnerability is a big word, and it's a scary word. And as I said, it's not actually reasonable to ask people to walk into public spaces and be vulnerable. But some kind of building blocks of that, that are, I think, doable, or, you know, just cultivating curiosity, like actually genuinely, and this is something you have to work on in yourself before the conversation starts, because if you don't mean it, that will transmit itself physically. But you really, really do want to understand. And just to break that down a little bit more, just to take into a conversational space a willingness to be surprised, even a hope that you'll be surprised. Mm-hmm. And if you think about how we generally approach our public conversational spaces, it's the opposite, right? Like, we know exactly what that person is about because we've defined them because of who they voted for or some side of an issue they're on. In fact, we're all so strange and complicated, and we all bring behind every position or every word that we speak, our whole lives are behind that. And if we can get curious about the lives behind that, what a conversation we could begin in that way.
My question, your program is called On Being, your book is called Becoming Wise, and I'm curious about the interplay between being and becoming.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a big question. I'll just say that the becoming word is just as important as the wise word, and it's not a destination. It's a lifelong process and adventure. And also, well, you're not old. but this phrase, old and wise, is it fails us, right? There's a wisdom that a 4-year-old has, and there's a wisdom that a 21-year-old has, this impatience and this ability to see the world as it should be, and this desire to throw oneself at it. That is a wisdom that the world needs, that we need to accompany. And so I think wisdom is something that is possible at every age and that we cultivate, but it is absolutely a matter of becoming and not being.
I just wanted to ask you, how do you coax the importance of being bored and reflective and into the public imagination? Wouldn't that require that we discard a lot of the lifestyle habits that we have today?
Well, I mean, I think boredom's a great diagnostic that you're in the early stages of paying attention. Yeah, you've just lost your imagination for a moment. You've just lost the whole sense of privilege and the astonishing gift of the color blue, for instance, which we've co-evolved with for hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah. So the ability to understand how miraculous it is to be able to see another person's face, yeah, to be able to stand up and walk. John O'Donohue used to say, because he worked with a lot of ill people and dying people, and said there's people in this world who would give every last penny they have just to be able to swing their legs over the side of the bed, stand up and walk across the room, and they can't do it. Yeah. And just looking at other people walking nonchalantly down the street. Yeah. So even to this day, I've tried to keep that sense of privilege. And you could say, you know, that all of our great spiritual disciplines, all of our great artistic disciplines, have to do with a fierce attention and intentionality to the otherness of life. And it's usually you're bored when this self you're constructed is not being corroborated in its usual way. So to shift the self away from this discrete thing we've constructed ourselves to this frontier, which is the meeting between what you think is you and what you think is not you, it's very hard to be bored at that place. It's movable, it's tidal, it's changing, it's constantly asking for listening and speech. You know? So I'd say boredom's just a doorway. It's a doorway into looking for the next context to emerge. I think that poem that works with that, maybe we could finish with this.
Is that Everything is Waiting for You?
Everything is Waiting
for
You.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to finish. Yeah.
This is Everything is Waiting for You. It's a title that sounds vaguely positive to begin with, until you realize that everything is waiting for you, yeah. Including your own disappearance, yes. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you courage. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything, everything, everything is waiting for you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Ways of Being in the World, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in March 2017 with Krista Tippett and David White. Thank you for joining us, and do come again.